In our last case this morning, 2023-0631, Phoenix Lighting Group, LLC, versus Genlight Thomas Group, LLC. On behalf of the appellant, Mr. Sisse, good morning. Happy New Year.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. Ben Sisse for appellant Genlight Thomas Group, LLC, doing business as Date Bright Capri Omega. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time.
You may proceed.
DCO has been seeking for nearly 4 years the final judgment this court ordered in Phoenix One. This appeal asks whether a superior court's mandate requiring entry of final judgment for a specific amount of attorney fees leaves open the issue of appellate fees. The answer is no. Final judgments are meant to be final, and a lower court cannot stray from a superior court's mandate. So when this court issues a mandate requiring entry of final judgment, the trial court has to comply and issue a final judgment that strictly complies with that mandate. No further proceedings are allowed. Now, I'd like to start with clearing away a little of the underbrush here. At paragraph 16 of the Ninth District's decision, they refer to their prior remand. But by the time this court issued its opinion in Phoenix One, there was nothing left for the trial court to do except enter the judgment this court ordered on attorney fees. If you look at the entries, the trial court had already aligned its decision with the Ninth District Court of Appeals before this court issued Phoenix One. That's at appendix pages 58 and 59. And then after that, the trial court also allowed Phoenix to execute on every single award except the award for attorney fees. That's at appendix pages 54 and 55. So by the time this court issued its mandate in Phoenix One, there literally was nothing left for the trial court to do except enter the final judgment this court ordered for nearly $2 million in attorney fees. Now, the Ninth District thought it mattered at paragraph 19 that the Phoenix went back to the trial court and filed a new motion after this court issued its decision, but before the trial court entered the final judgment this court ordered. But that tactic violates this court's rule in Transamerica Insurance versus Nolan. There, the insureds filed a motion after an appellate mandate, but before the trial court had issued a final judgment for the insurers. And they argued that the failure of the trial court to have issued a final judgment by that point in time left the case open, and so they were free to return to the trial court and file a Rule 60B motion citing intervening authority. This court said no. The appellate mandate required the trial court to enter final judgment, and the trial court had to act accordingly and enter the judgment this court ordered. A litigant cannot return to a trial court and, through creative motions, avoid the final judgment this ordered by a superior court's mandate. The rest.
Would your analysis change if the appellees here prevailed on the appeal completely? In other words, the enhancement, the lodestar, all of that, if they had prevailed, would you still, your position would still be after the remand, they could not move a court for post-judgment or appellate fees?
I don't think, my position would still be the same, Your Honor, for this reason. I think you have to, and this is, I believe, consistent with Klein. It's also consistent with State XREL Mather versus Oda, I would argue, that this court issued recently at the end of last year. But there has to be a remand for more proceedings for the trial court to do it. What could have happened here, and what we point out in our brief, is they could have come to this court after they won, and they could have asked for, through a motion for reconsideration, for the court to alter its mandate and include a remand for assessment of trial fees before the trial court. And at that point in time, the trial court would have been vested with jurisdiction. And that would be similar, actually, to what happened in the Royster case that we cite in our briefs.
But why would this court reconsider the remand when that wasn't part of the issue before us? What if they didn't even ask for appellate fees? We would be putting the cart before the horse in this case.
I mean, if they never asked for appellate fees, then the case is over, right? That would be our position. There's nothing left to do. Case is over. There's no remand. If this court issues a mandate saying judgment affirmed but does not remand for further proceedings, then they could file and ask for this court to modify its mandate and do a remand for further proceedings. What they could also do is what happened in Royster, which is where I started to go. And there was a motion for attorney fees filed with this court before this court issued its merits decision. And this court, in its discretion, decided as part of the mandate to remand for an assessment of appellate fees. And of course, all of this assumes that the proceedings before this court were the first opportunity where they could have sought appellate fees, and we know that's not true. Really, what they could have done and probably should have done after the Ninth District decision was filed a motion with the Ninth District, which is exactly the kind of motion that Klein authorized, and now, after Cruz, is available in common law fees as well as statutory fees, but exactly the motion that Klein authorized. And at that point, the Ninth District could have awarded fees either before the appeal was filed with this court and this court accepted jurisdiction, or at a minimum, they could have said in their merit brief to this court, hey, I have this pending motion for appellate fees before the Ninth District. Please remand to the Ninth District for a ruling on that motion. My point is, when you do none of that, which is what happened here, and you wait until the case is over, you can't go back to the trial court and reopen the case with a belated motion. There is no authority once this case is at an end and there's a final judgment to go back to the trial court.
Even if it's characterized as post-judgment?
Yes, Your Honor, even if it's characterized as post-judgment. I don't believe there is such a thing as post-judgment attorney fees. I think that's inconsistent with this court's holding in International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers versus Vaughan Industries, that attorney fees are part of the final judgment. If they're part of the final judgment, they can't be post-judgment. And sure,
it would be different from post-judgment interest.
It would be different from post-judgment interest. This court said in International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers versus Vaughan Industries that there is no final order on appeal unless either the attorney fees are resolved or the trial court makes a 54B determination and severs the attorney fees claim from the remaining claims. And here there was no 54B determination, and so the attorney fees had to be resolved as part of a judgment. You can't have post-judgment fees when the resolution of fees is critical to the issuance of a final judgment.
I understand your argument that we should do this just based on the mandate, but it seems that the problem here is that Cruz has so complicated the issue of post-judgment fees that it's impossible to figure out. I mean, wouldn't a better way to deal with this would be to overrule our decision in Cruz?
Well, now you may be getting me in trouble with other members of the court, but I appreciate the question.
No, he doesn't care about that.
Here's what I will say about Cruz, and specifically about appellate attorney fees, and specifically about a mandate. The thing I don't see in the Cruz majority opinion is an explanation for why you can introduce additional evidence of what the common law characterizes as damages when there's been a remand for a recalculation of an existing attorney fees award. And that, in my mind, fundamentally distinguishes common law attorney fee awards from statutory attorney fee awards, because at common law they were part of damages and they were originally awarded by the jury. And this court got away from that in the digital analog case, where it said the jury is allowed to say reasonable attorney fees are available, but they can be decided later in a hearing. But to me, it's a bridge too far if you're going to say that they can be decided later at a hearing, but then if there's a remand that doesn't expressly allow a retrial on damages, say, or that element of damages, to allow you to go forward and then add additional evidence of damages, which is what attorney fees are at common law. Having said all that, this court doesn't need to go there to recognize, under its recent precedent in State ex rel Mather versus Oda, that when you have a remand that has a limited and specific direction, there it was to issue a nunk-pro-tunk entry. Here it was to issue a final judgment for a specific amount of attorney fees. When you have a remand of that character that's limited, it does not authorize further proceedings, and it does not authorize the filing of a motion for appellate attorney fees. And so under this court's recent precedent, you could decide this case on that basis without needing to revisit Cruz. And, you know, I guess the one other thing I would mention out briefly, there's a reference to Civil Rule, I think, 54D and costs. But really, when you look at it, the motion for attorney fees has to be filed within 28 days of the original judgment in the trial court, and that's Civil Rule 59B. And then the only reference the other side has for the 54D reference to costs is Klein and Cruz. And aside from whether we stay with Cruz or depart from it, what this court said in State Ex Rel Mather versus Oda is neither Klein nor Cruz speak to the issue of when you are allowed to return to the trial court and ask for attorney fees. And in State Ex Rel Mather versus Oda, this court was quite clear that the correct question is what further proceedings, if any, are allowed by a superior court's mandate. And if a superior court's mandate does not authorize the Common Pleas Court to conduct further proceedings, then no further proceedings may be conducted. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time if there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Witchie.
Good morning.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to the Ohio Supreme Court as well. Good morning. My name is Jeff Witchie. I speak on behalf of Phoenix Lighting Group this morning. First and foremost, and dispositive of this case at the outset, the Phoenix Trial Court followed the mandate precisely. It did not stray from this court's mandate. In Phoenix 1, this court remanded for a further proceeding the issuance of a final judgment. Now, this substantive proceeding re-engages the trial court's judicial jurisdiction. And that's in contrast with what happened in the Mather case recently decided by this court, where on remand, this court instructed the trial court to perform a ministerial task of correcting the record with a nunc-pro-tunc entry, just to make sure that that record more accurately reflected what had already occurred in that case. Now, when a trial court issues a final judgment, it has to do two things. It has to issue the award, and that was done in this case by our trial court, in the amount down to the dollar that this court instructed. There was no additor, no remitter, there was no interest added, no enhancement, down to the dollar. Then the court needs to complete that process, and that's the process, complete that process with the assessment of case costs. And that's not a voluntary process. That's a process that is required by Civil Rule 54D. And then under this court's decisions in Cruz and Klein and Christie, post-judgment fees, especially when supported by a statutory fee shift, are case costs. And they may be awarded by the trial court in its discretion. So citing this court's decision in Klein, our trial court explicitly stated the post-judgment fees it was issuing were, and I quote, to be assessed as costs. That's on page 9 of her June 19, 2020 decision. Now, DCO has no response for this. It deflects with saying that we are engaging in revisionist history. They say on page 8 of their reply brief, Phoenix never asked for appellate fees as cost under Rule 54D. But I would quickly draw the court's attention to page 5 of the transcript of the oral argument before the trial court. That's in our supplement, where I specifically referenced Rule 54D, and this was right after we filed our motion. We also argued it on page 5 of our appellee's brief. But my question is, did we really need to? Because Rule 54D is the only rule that covers final judgments and the assessments of costs. The title of it is Judgments and Costs.
Why should your client, why should you recover costs when DCO prevailed, at least in part, on their appeal?
Because the appellate court on page 37 of its original decision, and you have to be careful to not look at the Westlaw or Lexis version, but the original decision, they awarded case costs to Phoenix. There was a taxation of costs against DCO.
But why isn't that trial case cost?
That would be appellate cost because they had already gone through the appellate procedure. So at that point in time when they are taxing costs, those are appellate costs. And their remand for further proceedings covers those costs. And we have not yet to this day been paid those costs. So when my opposing counsel indicates that everything was paid, that's not true. We were not paid those costs. Those costs now include all of the attorney fees and everything that are awardable under the Klein decision. And I would also point out that this was not a belated motion. Until we know what happens on the enhancement issue before the court, we don't even know what our costs are going to be.
Back up, just help me understand. I guess I still have a hard time wrapping my head around the fact that someone exercises their right to appeal, they're successful on appeal, and as punishment for their success, they have to pay the other side's attorneys. How does that make any sense?
Your Honor, we did not request attorney fees for the time spent on the enhancement issue before the Supreme Court. We specifically left that out because those would have been fees that were segregable from the fees that we incurred when we on all the issues we won. And the appellate court affirmed every decision of the trial court in this case. So we are only asking for fees now related to the parts of the case that we won, which is why we waited to file until the end, like this court instructed in the Klein case. And I would also point out that the Klein case and the Cruz case were both cases where there was a remand back to this court, but it wasn't for the purpose of post-judgment attorney fees. It was actually for the purpose of pre-judgment attorney fees, but still the court was able to engage in that debate, just like the Supreme Court of the United States did in the case Sprague versus Titanic National Bank. And I have to make an admission here. I should have made a much bigger production out of that case in our brief. Because in that case, the United States Supreme Court remanded the case to the trial court with the mandate not just to enter a final order, but to execute on it for a certain sum of money. At the trial court, the plaintiff petitioned for its fees, its attorney fees. The trial court said no. It had no further function to perform other than to carry out the mandate of the Supreme Court. Now, the plaintiff then appeals this decision back to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reverses with its universally applied holding now that while a mandate is controlling as to matters within its compass, on remand, a lower court is free as to other issues.
Help me understand how this works. So, there's a mandate. So your position is essentially there's a mandate. The court has to do what the mandate says, but then the court is free to do anything else it wants. Is that pretty much it?
Well, in this particular case, we have to look at the mandate. The first thing the mandate does is it says that it's applying just to the portion of the appellate court award.
So if an appellate court wants to issue a mandate that ends the case, it has to say, trial court, do this, and don't do anything else, or don't do all these X, Y, Z. And that's usually not the way courts work. They usually tell lower courts what to do. So I'm trying to understand now how it would work going forward.
Okay. The first thing is, like this court mentioned in Durkin, I think it was paragraph 17 of Durkin versus Williams. In that case, it referred to a trial court's residual powers when a matter is brought back down on appeal, but it's operating on an issue that is outside the compass of a mandate. And then in paragraphs 28 and 29, it held that any restrictions on the trial court's residual powers on remand must expressly restrict or specifically limit those proceedings. It said an implied restriction is insufficient. And then paragraph 29 also stresses the importance of clarity in the mandate and any restrictions so that a party would know whether it needs to file a motion for reconsideration or an appeal. And DCO constantly harpoons us for not filing a motion for reconsideration in this case. But our motion, if we filed that motion for reconsideration, we would have been assuming that this court is intended to silently rule on an issue that it didn't even have jurisdiction to consider because it hadn't accepted that jurisdiction over the prejudgment fee issue. Additionally, DCO criticizes us for taking sound bites from cases where there were general remands. But in my reading of the case law all across Ohio, courts place little to no focus on whether a mandate is actually a general mandate or a specific mandate. Instead, they actually focus on the actual mandate. And they ask themselves, is this court using its residual powers, this trial court, is it exercising its powers in a manner that is consistent with the mandate? And if it's consistent with the mandate, I have yet to see a court be stripped of its residual powers. I've looked at a lot of the cases. If someone finds one, it's an anomaly, and DCO must not have found any because they didn't cite any. Instead, they cite cases where a court, whether it's working inside the mandate or outside the mandate with its residual powers, is in direct defiance or violation of the mandate. Now, DCO says, you know, final judgments are meant to be final judgments. But when we look at the actual mandate in this case, it is clear that the mandate was meant to apply to only one portion of the award. The appellate court had affirmed all the other decisions. It had affirmed the compensatory damages, it had affirmed the punitive damages, and it also made that award of costs. And its remand applied to all of those matters as well. So in essence, our trial court was operating off of two remands here. One remand was from this court that required it to finish the filing of the final judgment. Even though it was only to that portion of the case, it still had to make an assessment of costs under Rule 54D, and it was also operating off the more general remand of the appellate court with respect to the rest of the decision. Third, we have to understand that a mandate cannot be read in a vacuum, especially when the mandate itself references the fact that it needs to be read consistent with the opinion. And that was the language this court used in its mandate. And when you look at the decision and the opinion of the court starts with the fact that it explained exactly what it took jurisdiction over, and it was the prejudgment fee issue only, the enhancement of the prejudgment fee only. And contrary to what DCO is telling us, this court kept its word. The only issue it took argument over was the prejudgment fee award. The only issue it decided was the prejudgment fee award. And it was meticulously clear about this. Additionally, it put no prohibition against the trial court addressing post-judgment fees, especially, or let alone one that meets the Dirk in paragraphs 28 and 29 requirements of clarity and explicit expression of restrictions. I would also point out that there was such a similar mandate in the Sprague case, and that did not stop the U.S. Supreme Court from finding that the attorney fee request was not barred by that mandate. Now, DCO faults the trial court, actually, for extending or varying the mandate. But I guess I would ask, who's extending the mandate here? Is it the trial court or is it DCO? Because it seems to me that DCO is seeking to expand the compass of the mandate to include an issue that this court never took jurisdiction over, that this court never accepted argument on, and that this court did not decide. And there's a State X Rel Ames versus Portage County Commissioners, paragraph 69, the court said this very well. It said that the law of the case doctrine does not reach a matter that was not decided. Our post-judgment fees here were not decided by this court. DCO also argues that there's no such thing between pre-judgment fees and post-judgment fees. Well, every court that I've looked at, all these decisions, it's all against the framework of there being pre-judgment decisions and pre-judgment fees and post-judgment fees. That's the framework that all of these cases are set up on.
Do you mean fees or costs?
So attorney fees are considered costs, correct, when they are granted pursuant to a remedial statute. And we find that in the Christie case decided by this court.
Isn't that your strongest argument?
Is that my strongest argument?
Isn't it?
I believe it is, because at the very beginning of my presentation today, I believe it's dispositive of this case, that these were costs and that there was a requirement for our trial court to issue an assessment of costs pursuant to Civil Rule 54D.
And even without the statute, going back to 1924, essentially we've had the theory in Ohio that the nature of the incidental damages allowed are essentially an expense of successfully asserting your rights, correct?
That is correct. That is correct, and that's exactly the way the court did decide the case in the Christie case. I can see my time has run over. I do have an additional point, if possible, or...
You may proceed. Short.
Yes. DCO cites in their brief the case of International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers versus Vaughn for the proposition that Rule 54B, now I'm talking B as in boy, could be used. And to the extent that can be used, that could be like obiter dicta to this case. That may be a way that a court might proceed to reserve jurisdiction to decide an attorney fee award. But that's just not the way it happened in this case. We have two remands that reestablished our trial court's award. So with that, if there are any other questions, I shall close. Thank you.
Mr. Sasay, you have 4 minutes and 12 seconds remaining.
Thank you. I'm struck by the never-ending spiral of issues that can arise if you don't obey the normal procedure of funneling litigation down as it continues through when an entry of final judgment is ordered, requiring a trial court to actually enter that final judgment. We heard an awful lot about costs and an awful lot about a U.S. Supreme Court case. But if this court recalls, when it wrote and issued Phoenix 1, it said at paragraph 25 of the decision that attorney fees were not awarded under the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. And so it was law of the case in this particular lawsuit that there was no award of attorney fees under the Trade Secrets Act. And so there could have been no award of attorney fees as costs. And this idea that, you know, these issues, these fees are always called post-judgment fees. Well, just take a look at page 49 of their merit brief in Phoenix 1. Did they use the term post-judgment attorney fees? They did not. They simply asked for post-trial attorney fees and fees incurred, you know, pursuing their claims on appeal. And that, by the way, actually aligns this case with the State Actual Mather versus Oda case that we were discussing the last time I was up here. Because there, as here, the appellees included a request in their merits brief for a remand for attorney fees. There, as here, the Court of Appeals issued, or in this case, the Supreme Court, a mandate with a limited and specific directive.
But do they have to really say that it's costs? I mean, the law already treats it that way.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Say
they
that
have to actually characterize those attorneys' fees, post-judgment attorneys' fees, as costs if the law already characterizes it that way?
Well, they absolutely would in this case, Your Honor, because this court had already said as law of the case that they were not awarded attorney fees under the Trade Secrets Act, and therefore they could not have been costs here. They would have been a common law fee award, and it would have been treated as compensatory damages. And that's true under this court's decision in Cruz. It's true under this court's decision in Phoenix One. And it's been true going all the way back through the Roberts case in the 1920s.
Well, but isn't that an issue? I mean, the issue before us was whether jurisdictionally the trial court could award additional fees, not whether the trial court erred in awarding the fees. Correct?
The issue here is whether the trial court can award fees. Yes, Your Honor. And what I'm saying is, both under the mandate rule and the law of the case, it cannot. The attorney fees statute, it is now pressing before this court. This court had already said that they have forfeited that argument at paragraph 25 of the decision because there was no fee award under that statute. This court then remanded to issue a final judgment on a common law fee award for slightly less than
$2
million.
But if we don't find that argument well taken, then your client loses this case because you didn't argue any substantive error in the award itself?
I'm sorry, substantive error in what regard?
In the regard of awarding fees, assuming that we say the court did have jurisdiction, that it wasn't, it did have the ability to consider fees when it went back on remand. If we say yes to that, then there's no other argument.
Well, the only proposition of law this court accepted was on whether or not the trial court had power to order right. attorney fees. So yes, I mean, there would be no argument left here.
Okay.
But I think the key point here, Your Honor, mm-hmm. is if you look at Klein and you look at Cruz and you look at Mather, Klein started the process and it said it was adopting a practical approach to attorney fees. It said the Court of Appeals would award fees when it ends the case. But if there is a remand for additional proceedings, that's the word this court used in Klein, additional proceedings, then a trial court may award fees. Okay, and so then you go through that to Cruz. Cruz talks about the practical approach, doesn't say it's altering the practical approach. Mather says that practical approach doesn't allow for appellate attorney fees when the mandate does not allow for additional proceedings. And here, the mandate did not allow for additional proceedings. So under this court's own cases, we don't need to look at something from the U.S. Supreme Court from the 1930s. Look at Klein, look at Cruz, look at Mather. And if you look at those three cases, you'll see that the trial court had no power to enter an award of additional attorney fees. Thank you, Your Honor. I can see my time is up.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You will receive a decision by the court. Marshal, please close the court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.